first had the pleasure of meeting our speaker this morning through my work, actually, as an art teacher in Newton. She had two wonderful, charming, intelligent, talented, gifted children that were in my art classes. Their names are Meredith and Lucas. Meredith and Lucas have both graduated college, and Meredith is in Taiwan now. Actually, she's visiting in Des Moines at the moment. And Lucas graduated in history. But he also almost graduated in physics, I think, too. So it's like very talented people. Over the years, our speaker has spent nearly 20 years in the private practice of law in Iowa. And in 2000, she was hired by the Iowa Department of Education as the chief legal counsel. Her duties also included serving as the department's administrative law judge, coordinator of administrative rules, and the department's liaison to governing boards of the Iowa High School Athletic Association. She also is a member of the National and Iowa Associations of Administrative Law Judges, the National Council of State Education Attorneys, where she served as president in 2006, and National Program Chair in 2005 and 2007. Our speaker is a member of Plymouth United Church of Christ, which I'm also a member, here in Des Moines, where she also has taken residence up in the urban Renaissance area downtown. She serves on church boards like the Homeless Assistance Team and the Stewardship Board. She is firmly committed to the LGBT movement through her interest and support in things like the Des Moines Gay Men's Chorus. And she's also participated in the Pride Parade and even asked the chorus to sing at her late husband Gordon's funeral. She's an official volleyball, football, swimming, and track and field official. She has also shaken hands with 39 Olympians. I've known many Carols in my life, but if I had to name my favorite one, it would be Carol Greta, this morning's speaker. Please welcome my friend and education advocate, Carol Greta.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me. One of the things that Rick didn't tell you was that my last day of work at the Department of Education was July 5th. For many reasons, I decided it was time to give the new director an opportunity to put somebody of his own choosing in there. So I've been a drag on society ever since. But because I was in private practice for so long, I really do need to be IPERS covered. And so instead of being able to dish the dirt and let fly with all of the inside scoop, I've got to be mindful that I still need to work somewhere and hopefully IPERS covered. I've never been known for a lack of candor. So I think we'll have fun this morning. Now, I was one of the few people at the Department of Education who was not an educator before I came there. So I really don't know how many hours a day a kid should be in school and what the curriculum should consist of and all of those things that people debate about when they start those debates about how many angels dance on the head of a pin. But I did have the privilege during the 12 years I was with the department of doing a lot of speaking around the state and sometimes nationally. And one of my favorite topics I'm going to impose on you, and that is, why does student free speech matter? And it's important to us in Iowa because it all starts with the Tinker case. How many of you, did any of you grow up in Des Moines in the 60s? Ah, okay. Did you go to Roosevelt, Gary?
No, but I know the Black Congress.
Yeah, yes, indeed.
I was at Roosevelt at the time.
Great.
And I knew the Tinkers.
Okay, then you know the irony is that, you know, the iconic photo of that case is that of John Tinker, who was at Roosevelt High School at the time, and one of his male friends who were there posing on the steps with their black armbands. The irony is that John was the reluctant Tinker, Mary Beth, who was in what we called junior high at the time, was the gung-ho one. She was the one who would listen in as their parents. Their dad was a Methodist minister, but he had more of an affinity in his heart for the Quakers. Their mom, I forget what her avocation or vocations were, but they were both very interested in protesting the involvement of the United States in the Vietnam War. So they had a lot of gatherings at their house to which the children would listen. And there was also a little brother in elementary school at the time, too. And the kids caught this fever, and they really wanted to find a way to express their disapproval of the involvement of the United States in the Vietnam War at school. So they came upon the idea of the black armbands.
You know, there's a second family called the Eckerns. Chris Eckern and his family, you're just about the same effect. There's some controversy that maybe, ask Dan Johnston, that Eckern should have been listed first, and I think there was some bad feelings as a result of that.
Uh-huh. Well, and you know, of course, the case is Tinker versus Des Moines Public Schools. But there also, a little later on, we'll talk about a case in which, even though it went all the way to the United States Supreme Court, the family's last name was misspelled throughout all of the documents. It happens. So anyway, the children decided they would all go to school wearing their black armbands. The teachers, although there was no written policy, the principals got together, they heard about this, and they said, well, we can't have this. And so they met the kids at the door. This was like the week before Christmas break. They still called it Christmas break, would start. They met the kids and said, you can't come in to school unless you take off the armbands. The kids went home. The next day they came with the armbands again, were sent home, and then their dad said, well, you know, this is foolish. I want you to get an education. We'll just sue. And so they took and went all the way to the United States Supreme Court, where up until then, 1969 was the year that this case was came down, there had been no student free speech cases that had gone to the United States Supreme Court. Which is kind of mind-boggling when you think about the litigious nature of society. But that was it. The other thing that we kind of tend to forget is that Tinker was by no means a unanimous case, a decision. It was a 6-3 decision. But the majority gave us those famous words that neither students nor teachers shed their constitutional rights of freedom of speech or expression at the schoolhouse gate. The case, the majority went on to write, and I think this is more important. If you take nothing else from this today, please remember these words or a reasonable facsimile of these words, that schools are educating the young for citizenship is reason for the scrupulous protection of constitutional freedoms of the individual. If we are not to strangle the free mind at its source, and teach youth to discount important principles of our government as mere platitudes. In other words, the hallways of school are to be places of the free intercourse of ideas and the exchange of expression in a civilized way. Now, the court went on to say, but we live in the real world, and we understand that educators need a few guidelines about what to do when those children who I raised two of myself who are smart asses, come to school, and want to be disruptive. So they said, okay, look, there are two times when educators may regulate student speech at school. One is when that speech infringes on the rights of others. I can't go to school wearing a t-shirt that says, everybody beat up on Rick Miller today at lunch. That would infringe on Rick's right. The other time is when the behavior or when the speech causes a reasonable expectation of a substantial disruption of the education environment. For a long time, educators should have been memorizing that phrase, and they didn't. We'll get to the consequences of that a little later. But it's a reasonable expectation, you don't have to wait for the disruption to happen, of a substantial disruption of the education environment. And by the way, it cannot be a disruption caused by faculty. back at Roosevelt High School once again, but just like 3 years ago, there were two sisters who were from a family that was very much pro-life. I hate that they've co-opted that term, but that's the term that everybody will understand. So they wore T-shirts that they had silk-screened with the image, a very graphic image of an aborted fetus on it. Well, they came to school, and the kids were just, oh, well, that's those sisters. We, you know, no news there. It was the faculty that was in an uproar about those T-shirts. But the attorney for the school wisely said, no, you cannot, they're not disrupting the education environment. The teachers sure as hell are. But the kids are not. They're expressing their view. They're not infringing on the rights of others. Now, frankly, in a much smaller school where maybe it would have been well known that a young lady had just had an abortion, and it, you could put two and two together and say that, that was, she was being targeted, you might have a different result because, frankly, there's not much that's very black and white about any of this. It's all situational. It all comes down to the facts and circumstances. But the disruption cannot originate with the faculty. So there's Tinker. And we went along for another 15 years before the Supreme Court had a chance to say anything else about student free speech. And when they did, it was really a couple of cases that were no-brainers. But they're fun to talk about. Matt Frazier was a student in school in Washington State. Matt was a junior. He was a pretty sharp kid. He'd been asked by a friend of his to give a nomination speech for the friend who was running for class officer. The nomination speeches were to be made at a school assembly, mandatory school assembly. So he had, Matt Frazier had a captive audience of 9th graders through 12th graders. He worked very, very hard on his speech, and it was totally inappropriate. It makes me giggle every time I read it because I have a very inappropriate sense of humor. And when I talk about this, I tell people to go ahead and Google Bethel School District v. Frazier, and then I hear the guffawing out in the audience, and I know somebody's Googled it right then and there. But it was full of sexual innuendo. I mean, he wasn't even very, well, he wasn't at all subtle about the sexual innuendo. You know, he was saying things like, I know a man who's firm. He's firm in his shirt. He's firm in his pants. And he will drive home. And it got to the point where you had the reaction of everybody from the little freshman who had that deer in the light headlights look, like, what's he talking about? To a group of freshman boys who were oh so worldly and who were standing up, hooping and hollering and acting out the sex act. And even that was not a unanimous Supreme Court case. But the majority said, yes, schools, you can regulate speech that is patently lewd and offensive and crude and disruptive. You know, come on, people, let's get a grip. So that's a bad choice of words. When I would speak nationally, I'd talk about the Hazelwood case because that was about censorship of student publications, the student newspaper, the yearbook, etc. But the nice thing is, I don't talk about it in Iowa or never talked about it in Iowa because when that case came down and said, yes, schools, you can censor student publications, the Iowa legislature at the time, this was in 1988, passed a law saying, no, you can't, not in Iowa. You can only censor student publications if they are libelous or if they are advocating some illegal activity, a crime, or advocating that students bring beer to school or something illegal like that. So that's that third one. So for a long, those are the nationally known as the triumvirate of school, of student speech cases. We need some refinements though. Because over the years, what's happened is that we have gang symbols now. Now, 15 years ago, the big gang symbol case in Iowa was a federal court case, but it went no farther than the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals. Poor little Amy Stevenson had a cross tattooed on one of her fingers And had it there for years and years and years, and then the Davenport School District passed an anti-gang policy that said no tattoos. Well, hers was not gang-related, but she was petrified of not being able to complete her education, and she actually undertook the very painful experience of having that tattoo eradicated so she wouldn't be kicked out of school. And then the Eighth Circuit said, sorry, the Davenport policy is void because it's too vague. Honestly, these days, with the proliferation of gangs in some of our communities, I think we may have had a different result. I think courts are cutting schools a little more slack when they are trying to deal proactively with things like that. But at the time, though, the policy, I also think a school board would be a little smarter than Davenport's wasn't dumb, but they just didn't know at the time to put more specificity into their policy. The court inexplicably in 2007, the United States Supreme Court, took up a case from Alaska. Anybody remember the bong hits for Jesus cases? Yeah. A typical smart-ass kid, Joe Frederick. He's a senior up at Anchorage, Alaska. His principal, Deborah Morse, announces that this was the Winter Olympics torch, so it was either 98 or 2002. It was a Winter Olympic year. The Olympic torch was going to be coming through Anchorage right past their high school. Joe Frederick said to himself, where there's an Olympic torch, there are TV cameras. I need to get on TV. So he thought to himself, how do I get on TV? So he bought like this 8-foot roll of paper, 8 feet by 4 feet. He wrote Bong Hits for Jesus on it. He later testified he didn't know what it meant. He had seen it on a surfboard. So, now you should be thinking to yourselves, Anchorage kid, surfboard. I'm not, making that connection. But anyway, that's what he testified to. At the last minute, he unfurls this. So his principal, Deborah Morse, is standing on the other side of the street. She sees him unfurl this. She sees this about 1 second before the TV cameras see this. And she's got a nanosecond in which to decide whether to ignore it. Because ignoring, I tell educators, really is the better part of discretion in a lot of cases. Or to go over there and ask Joe Frederick to take down his poster. And she ran across the street and asked Joe Frederick to take down his poster. And he did. He then sued her. And the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which God bless the Ninth Circuit, because for sheer comic relief, I don't know if any of you watch the cases that the United States Supreme Court takes. There are 12, if I count the District of Columbia Courts of Appeals. So 1/12 of the cases you would think that the Supreme Court takes come from the Ninth Circuit. No, it's about 1/3 to 1/2. And the reversal rate is like 95%. It's like the New Yorker magazine once called them the court that gets their right legally, but they're totally clueless. Well, this time they didn't even get it right legally. They told Principal Morse she owed Joe Frederick $30,000 because the law of student free speech was so well settled that she should have known that she would be violating his free speech rights. That's pretty terrifying, really. So I'm glad, even though the Supreme Court ducked a lot of other cases that term, I'm glad they took this one because they said to the Ninth Circuit, look, not only is the law on student free speech not well settled, you didn't get it right. She did not violate Joe Frederick's free speech because he was obviously advocating illegal drug use. Now, that's how Chief Justice Roberts got there. I don't want to be too critical of the Chief Justice. I'm glad for Deborah Morse's sake that she was the wrong was righted, but sure, yeah, of course educators can regulate student speech that advocates illegal drug use. I mean, we already knew that. In the meantime, the cases that the court didn't take and really needs to take are the T-shirt cases. There's the Ninth Circuit again and the Seventh Circuit. It was in either an Illinois or an Indiana school. We're faced with pretty much identical T-shirts. On the front of each, they said, one of them said, homosexuality is shameful. I will not accept what God has condemned. And the back of it said, Romans 1:27. In the Seventh Circuit, the T-shirt said, be happy, not gay, and then had a Bible verse on the other side of it. In one case, the Ninth Circuit said to the school district, you can tell those kids not to wear homosexuality is shameful. You can regulate that shirt. The Seventh District said, no, you have to let the kid wear be happy, not gay. Those are just two illustrations, though. The courts are all over the place when it comes to T-shirts. There was an appeal taken to the Supreme Court. They are supposed to take cert when there is a split among the circuits, and they didn't. They have ducked it. So honestly, if it comes up in Iowa, I have no clue as to what would happen. But the T-shirt cases are a head-scratcher. One of my most uncomfortable moments sitting behind my desk at the department was when I got a call from a friend of mine, you may know him, Ryan Roberman, who said, there's a problem at one of our high schools. One of the kids, there's kind of a spat between the Gay-Straight Alliance up there and a group of kids who don't like the fact that there's a Gay-Straight Alliance up there. The people who don't like the GSA have developed shirts that say Friends Against Gays, F-A-G, with the F-A-G in big letters. He said, would you go up there and set them straight? I just got that. Okay, it's early. I said, no. I said, I'm sorry. They're not infringing on anybody's rights. I said, if we start playing fast and loose with the First Amendment, then we can't expect protection ourselves. Now, I was not happy doing that. Ryan was not happy with me. I don't think he's happy with me still. But I have to come down on the side of the First Amendment unless somebody is truly advocating violence or truly infringing on somebody else's rights. The kids who wore the fag T-shirts were announcing to the world who they were for them. You know, it was pretty obvious to make your own judgment, frankly. I still cringe a bit about that one because I don't know what the right answer is. I certainly don't pretend to know what the right answer is, but that's where I come down on these. The other place where the courts are just really kind of tied up in knots, because educators are too, Gene Roddenberry was wrong. Space is not the final frontier. Cyberspace is the final frontier. Those cases where kids are sitting at home on their personal little electronic devices, boy, do those ever, they always find their way to school. The aftermath, and they just tie educators up in knots. Nothing irritates me more, though, when I hear from an educator has said to a student who comes in to complain, well, I'm sorry, we can't do anything about it. It happened over the weekend, or it happened at night. Well, that's bullshit, because you can make the connection. If a student is truly being harassed or bullied electronically, and they come to an educator to complain about it, I tell the educator, look at that student in the eye and just ask one question. Does what happened at night or over the weekend on your personal device make you feel less safe here at school? And if the student has half a brain, they'll say, well, yeah. But there's the educator's entree into doing something about it, into disciplining the student who was the cyber bully. But too often, educators are afraid of what happens. We've got a wonderful case now, though, from the Fourth Circuit, which frankly is not one of the more enlightened circuits. We're talking Kentucky, Tennessee area. There's a young lady, her name was Kara. She did not like one of her fellow students, whose name was Shay. So Kara started this blog, virulently anti-Shay, spreading rumors about Shay has herpes, and that was the nicest thing that she said. Shay's parents heard about it, went to the school, and the school said, Kara, take it down. Kara took it down, but then initiated another blog, thinking that she had disguised Shay's name, but she, by that time everybody knew who she was talking about. And again, it went pretty viral. So the school punished Kara. They suspended her from class for 3 or 5 days and suspended her under the good conduct policy from any extracurricular activities for a whole semester, which meant that Kara could not crown her successor as Queen of Charm. My friend Mary Gannon, who's the attorney for the School Board Association, often says, you can't make this shit up. And you can't. Yeah. So guess who? What happened? Kara sued the school. Went all the way to the Fourth Circuit, which is just one step below the United States Supreme Court. And the Fourth Circuit, bless their hearts, said, Kara, come on. The school had every right to discipline you. In fact, and this is a case that's really good for educators, we could foresee that had the school not intervened, those verbal threats against Shay would have turned into physical threats against Shay. So of course the school had to do something at that point. You weren't just expressing an opinion about an issue. You were attacking a fellow student. Now on the other hand, so that's a very good one, that educators don't like the ones that point out that students have quite often used cyberspace to, as cathartic exercises, shall we say, to express their opinions about teachers or principals. But the courts have pretty uniformly said, put on your big boy and big girl panties and deal with it, educators. If the student goes too far, you've got remedies, but you cannot discipline those kids by suspending them from class. Courts are holding adults to a different standard than they are when it's a fellow student who's being attacked. I'm going to close with, well, there's just a bunch of funny cases, frankly, from the early days, which is like the 2001. The early days of trying to punish kids for what they're doing in cyberspace, because principals, God bless them, would say things like, well, yeah, I punished the kid. I didn't like the content of the website they created or their blog, etc. No, that's our C word. We don't go there. What they needed to have said was, this website, or whatever the kid was doing, created a reasonable expectation of a substantial disruption of the education environment. And then they could have, it's so easy to make your case once you utter those magic words. But educators were clueless in the beginning. They're getting a little better now. So these are fun cases to read, if you're kind of a geek like me. But I do want to close, because with the election coming up, with some words that were written not too long ago, maybe you'll recognize some of them. If there is any fixed star in our constitutional constellation, it is that no official, high or petty, can prescribe what shall be orthodox in politics, nationalism, religion, or other matters of opinion, or force citizens to confess by word or act their faith therein. If there are any circumstances which permit an exception, they do not now occur to us. Anybody recognize those words? They were quoted in Barnum. But they did not, Larry, but they did not originate with Chief Justice, now Chief Justice Kady in Barnum. He was quoting Justice Jackson from a school case, Barnett versus West Virginia, in which, back in World War II, Barnett undid a hideous wrong that was done to Jehovah's Witnesses just 3 years earlier. 3 years earlier, in a case called Gobitis, that's the one where the family name Gobitis was misspelled in every single document, even the United States Supreme Court case. In Gobitis, the Supreme Court said that the law, that they were pretty common back in World War II, that forced students in schools to salute the flag and say the Pledge of Allegiance. They said, well, your remedy, Jehovah's Witnesses, because it's against their religion to pledge to any symbol, any country, any flag. The Supreme Court told the Jehovah's Witnesses, your remedy is at the ballot box. Just vote out the people who voted in the state law, and that's your remedy. Sound familiar? That's what the anti-marriage equality folks are saying now, and thank God for Mike Gronstahl that he understands those words, that no official higher petty can do that. There are some things that are, well, the very purpose of the Bill of Rights is to withdraw certain subjects from the vicissitudes, I love that word, vicissitudes of political controversy, and to place them beyond the reach of majorities and officials, to establish them as legal principles. And so 3 years after Gobitis, we had a case called Barnett, from which those quotes come, in which the Barnett court said all of those good things. We were wrong to point people to the ballot box, because there are some issues that should be beyond the reach of majorities and officials. They should be established as legal principles. I just think that this was a wonderful time to remind ourselves of that. You know, Carl Menninger, one of the founders of the Menninger Clinic, said, what's done to children, they will do to society. And I firmly, firmly believe that. I don't care about the STEM initiative, science, technology, engineering, math. I care about educating citizens. And if we don't pay attention to the 10 words in the First Amendment, Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech, then what are we going to, we're just chunking out little robots who cross the stage. So I do think that freedom, student free speech matters, and that we all need to pay attention to it and be vigilant about it. Thank you for letting me express that here today. If there's any time, I'll answer any questions, except I won't talk about whether or not Tom Mihaljevic should keep his job or things like that. Gary?
I just saw a great cable on TV where it is, the outcome. And it is the cheerleaders in the Southern school have a religious banner, but then they have the football team on the cheerleaders. And of course, you have a conflict between free speech and also establishment of religion.
Yeah. Did everybody hear the question? That's not unlike the case from Kentucky a few years ago where the coaches were leading the public school team in prayer. And the court was actually savvy enough to say that, you know, even if you tell us now that the students are initiating the prayer, this was so ingrained that this really does look like established religion. You can't do it. I think it's the same with the cheerleaders. Even though now everybody may claim that it's student-initiated. No, it's not. It's not. It's being, at best, it's now being condoned by the adults. At worst, it's still being directed by the adults.
You mentioned bullying, and I appreciate that. One of the examples that you cited, Friends Against Gay and the Gays and the Gay Straight Alliance. At what point does something like that rise to bullying? I mean, it's emotional bullying, if nothing else, but...
Actually, the definition that the Iowa legislature has given us in the bullying law, the anti-bullying law, it sets a very high standard. Because bullying is purposeful activity. It's not reactive. You know, it's not, I'm having a bad day and yours is the first face I see and so you get to meet my knuckles. It's the systemic, planned, but it also, on the other side, has to have a substantial detrimental effect on the target. I don't say victim, by the way. I always say target, and that's, I think the thing I'm most proud of is that when I left the department, everybody was saying target. Because you and I can't choose whether we are the targets of somebody else's bad behavior, but we sure have a choice as to whether we let it victimize us. When I was an alternate district associate court judge, which is a title longer than I am tall, I saw too many people who had been the targets of assaultive behavior come into court and wear victimhood like a mantle. And it changed their lives, and they were ugly people for it. They went about acting as if, well, I was the victim here, and now that's my reason, my ticket to treat you badly, too. Legally, though, it takes a lot to really reach that threshold of bullying and harassment. Name-calling alone, the courts have said, is not it. It's got to be a viable threat to person or property that puts you in a reasonable apprehension, objectively reasonable. It's not the eggshell plaintiff.
I'm not sure how to approach it. Where does the parent-child relationship come into all this? You know, the child is assuming, the parents have no control over that. Every child has the same rights as an adult. I don't understand how. And it seems like some of these situations, if there had been some parental guidance, would never have come up.
And actually, the child can't sue unless the child's 18 or older. It was the parents on behalf of, or the legal term is as next friend to. So it's not that these kids are doing things and their parents aren't aware of it. It's the parents that are driving this. One thing I do want to mention before I forget, and this is so important because people like Mary Beth Tinker are doing this. Mary Beth lives in the Washington, D.C. area. She's helping students find their voice. She's very active in the gay and lesbian community in D.C., having come out herself. But when we help people, help students find their voices, those smart asses turn into very productive adults. Joe Frederick, he's a teacher nowadays. Matt Frazier went to work for AmeriCorps and is now a teacher. So, you know, when we don't just knee-jerk punish, but we try to nurture them and help them find their voices, they really do become very productive citizens.
You talked about the best friend of a child, and usually you assume that to be a parent. Can there be any advocates that are valuable or maybe harmful to a child being the best friend and taking a suit to them who are not parents?
It would have to be a guardian, and because a guardian's rights trump those of the parent, that would be very, very unusual.
Okay.
Yeah.
But it couldn't just be a friend down the block doing it
for a kid. No, it could not be.
So. Yeah, it's good. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Carol. We have a tradition of giving a token of appreciation to our speakers, and our tradition is to give a recording of the Des Moines Gay News.
Oh, wonderful.
So we wish you very enjoyable listening with that.
Oh, right. I shall.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Carol demonstrates the importance of having unsung heroes in our efforts. A grown-up, shall we say, behind the scenes, but in the room, and giving some grown-up advice to people who are trying to address some very difficult issues in a free society. There is an interesting coalescence. She began by talking about Tinker in 1969. 1969 also was the year of the Stonewall riots. It is not coincidental that as we finally came into the public arena as out, unapologetic, well-adjusted citizens who are gay and bisexual, that suddenly we are having to deal with these expressions of people who want to be our detractors. And I think that one of the perplexing issues has to do with those gray areas where we're not sure exactly which line this falls on. And I think it's a little bit like baseball. Tie goes to the runner. In tie situations, it goes to the speaker. And lest we feel too threatened by the fact that it has gone in favor of the speaker who has said something hateful or ignorant, bigoted, we need to remember that bigots are a lot like closeted gay men. You can't tell by just looking at them. This kind of thing brings them out in the open so that you can deal with them. You can lance the wound. You can respond to their ignorance. And when someone says something ignorant and says it out loud, then and only then do you have the real opportunity to set it right. And that's the strength, I suspect, of a real, genuine democracy. And we can actually be advantaged by letting the ties go to the speaker in our society. Thank you again for being a grown-up in the room over these years.